Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, debate, discussion, dialogue, entertainment, education, and answers to your emails, and call-in questions here on Ask Dr. Dawn. So I hope you'll stay tuned and maybe even join in the discussion. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. A little later in the show, I'm going to be talking about some recent, very intriguing research in chronic fatigue syndrome, a disease which is still under debate in medical circles about whether it's a real disease or a psychological disease. Which brings me to our first email. It's from Anne in Watsonville. My 26-year-old son has severe panic attacks / depression. My son began having severe panic attacks at age 21, but has never, to his knowledge or mine, had his blood tested for any physiological origin. My intuition is that he should have a blood sugar test and perhaps a hormone test. What's your feeling about this? I'm also concerned that he has been taking Zoloft and Ativan for many years. He feels discouraged that his doctors haven't been able to really help him feel well. Well, the reason I chose this email to start off with is because it betrays, I think, one of the great, let's just say, fallacies of our thinking in Western society, which is this dichotomy between the mind and the body. The idea that things are either mental or physical and that there is, in fact, some kind of barrier. You know, that's a little bit crazy. And there's literally no scientific basis for that. The mind and the body are, in fact, if you examine the science, intimately connected. You can think a thought, and that thought will, within a couple of minutes, be demonstrably received by the white blood cells circulating in your bloodstream. And in fact, we can then remove those white blood cells. And just from thinking a thought, we can see differences in the migration and phagocytotic activity of those white cells, meaning that they are differentially better or worse depending on the thoughts you're thinking. Now, this is all very scientific, but we don't really pay attention to the science actually in medicine as much as we should. So to go back to your question, it's better to ask, is there any physiology in your son that we might be able to adjust to help his psychology be more comfortable? And you're absolutely right that looking at physiologic triggers for his panic attacks would be a worthwhile goal. Some of the things that I would look at first would be a 3-hour glucose tolerance test where we see if his blood sugar is fluctuating wildly enough to act as a physiologic trigger for discomfort and set off a kind of chain reaction of events. Another thing I would look at would be complete thyroid function testing, which would not be just a TSH. It would also be looking at how his body processes thyroid. There are other more esoteric functional medicine things that might be looked at, examining, for example, how his mitochondria are working. A few minutes ago on NPR, we heard about a woman with a mitochondrial disease. Her disease manifests in such a way that up until very recently, she would have been dismissed as having a psychological disorder. We now understand that there are energy production errors which can occur in the mitochondria that can lead to severe and profound neurological dysfunction. So looking at something like a urine amino acid panel, what's called an organic acid panel, could be very useful in turning up those sorts of disorders. The other thing that should be addressed in anyone with panic attacks is attempting to proactively control the part of the physiology that is controlled by the brain. In other words, reducing the sympathetic fight or flight response and increasing the parasympathetic relax and rebuild response. And there are numerous types of mind-body therapies, Tai Chi, Qigong, yoga, different breathing exercises, visualization, hypnosis, neurolinguistic programming. I could go on and on with all of the different entities that do something. And really, there's lots of data that they are effective at improving the situation. So rather than thinking of this as a single cause and effect entity. You could think of it as a disrupted ecosystem that goes out of balance, and this ecosystem manifests the disruption with the panic attack. Now, it helps a lot to use drugs in people with panic attacks, and I'm not dissing the pharmacological aspects of things, but I want to emphasize that all pharmacology does is put a lid on things, or perhaps provide a floor, but it really doesn't do a lot for the middle part of the system in terms of keeping things balanced. It can reduce these severe oscillations, but it doesn't really get to the root of the problem. And I think a complex problem such as panic attack needs to be addressed in multiple directions. Problems? Well, it's expensive, it's difficult, it's time consuming. And of course, there's no support for that. But maybe there needs to be. And maybe we need to think a little bit outside the box for ourselves, rather than having a kind of passive, well, if my insurance won't pay for it, I can't do it approach, which I'm sorry to say is something that I hear from many, many patients. And I kind of want to stand them up and say, hey, you've got two legs, you've got the internet, you've got time to take classes at Park and Rec. You can do some of this on your own. Let me pull out my papers here and talk to you a little bit about what is either going to be yet another false alarm or what is going to be a major breakthrough in chronic fatigue. So I want to start with something that came out in Science Magazine, which is a very respected peer-reviewed journal. This was in late 2009. Scientists at a center in Nevada, and I'll have that location for you in a second, but the name of the lead researcher is Judy Mikovits, M-I-K-O-V-I-T-S, so you can find all of the information and more on this controversy by just Googling that name. Anyway, Dr. Mikovits and her team were researching chronic fatigue syndrome and have been particularly looking at something called xenotrophic murine retrovirus. This is a leukemia virus found in mice, and the xenotrophic part means that this is a strain of this type of virus which likes to infect other cells. Now, you remember back when we were talking about H1N1 flu about a year ago, we were discussing the idea that some viruses are able to jump species, and when and if they do, that can be a big deal. Well, the xenotrophic part of this virus means it is a virus that readily jumps species. In Mikovits' paper that was published in Science, they had a high percentage of their group with chronic fatigue syndrome were found to have evidence of this virus. In fact, 67% of the chronic fatigue patients, and only a few, single-digit percentage, of the normal controls. Well, this was quite a big deal in retrovirus circles, and as is appropriate in science, a lot of people set out then to see if they could replicate the study. And subsequently, about four labs failed to replicate this study. As it happens, most of those labs were in Europe. But that placed the whole thing in disrepute. Maybe it was just a false alarm. Perhaps, and this was the major criticism that was made by other labs, was that this is probably contamination. And I should explain that virus contamination is very easy to happen in a lab. And because viruses can live for a long time on surfaces and labware, it's very easy to have some contaminated glass or plastic or a contaminated machine and then inoculate all of your specimens with a virus. And then you can have a heck of a time figuring out whether or not you're really on to a genuine effect or whether you're just looking at cross-contamination. So the suggestion recently was that Mikovits' lab had just mistaken a cross-contamination because it had failed to replicate. A new paper just published, and published online, I might add, because it is so important, in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, has raised this issue again, saying, you know what, it may not be a cross-contamination issue at all. It may be that it's a regional issue. This study is the first study to attempt to replicate the XMRV data in the United States. And, you know, when I take a look at their methodology and where they got their specimens, It's a pretty good refutation. This group has been collecting serum and whole blood samples in chronic fatigue syndrome patients since the early 1990s, and they've been freezing them. So they went back and dug out those specimens and went back and tested them for the XMRV and MLV-related viruses. And they found a very high frequency of something called a GAG gene sequence, a GAG gene sequence that is specific for these murine leukemia-like viruses. It's not a human DNA at all. And they found it in 86%, that's 32 out of 37 of their chronic fatigue sample, and only about 7%, 3 out of 44, of healthy volunteer blood donors, which was where they got their samples. So that's a long time ago, back in the 1990s. And that adds a lot of credibility to the idea that this is not necessarily cross-contamination. It does, however, raise a big issue, which is, why are we finding this in United States laboratories and not in European laboratories? Now, what it really boils down to is that chronic fatigue syndrome has been implicated before with various types of infections. Human herpes virus, Epstein-Barr virus, parvovirus B19, Lyme disease, Q fever, they've all had their day in the sun as potential causative agents for chronic fatigue syndrome. So before we get too excited about this, I think it's important to really emphasize that correlation doesn't mean causality, and we have no mechanism for how this virus actually causes the disease. That being said, we also don't understand about the control groups coming up positive who don't have chronic disease and what's up with that. And could this just be another false trail? Whenever a controversy like this arises, particularly in a disease that has a political constituency like chronic fatigue, things tend to be framed in terms of conspiracies. It's the scientific establishment trying to prevent the forward motion of scientific knowledge. And I just really, really don't buy it on this one. Barry Marshall, who did the work on H. pylori and spent a long time, literally 10, 15 years, doing the research that established that ulcers are in fact largely or commonly caused by a bacterium, is always raised to imply that any researcher with a controversial idea who's bucking the establishment is going to be validated in the end. And you know, that ain't true either. The most frightening thing about this work for me right now, and the reason I wanted to talk about it and put caution out there, is that people are already leaping to the conclusion that this is a cause of chronic fatigue. And since it's a retrovirus, they're getting on board and starting to take antiretroviral drugs. That is to say, AIDS drugs, drugs that are decent in terms of risk-benefit when you're taking them with HIV, which is a life-threatening disease, but not, in my opinion, decent with respect to treating chronic fatigue syndrome in individuals where we haven't even established causality here. So a lot of brave people out there who are desperate, turning themselves into guinea pigs. I really want to discourage people from doing that because these are heavy-duty drugs and they might cause more harm than benefit. So taking a cautionary approach here and hopefully throwing a little light on an extremely murky issue. Hello, Keith in Pacific Grove. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was diagnosed with a blown rotator cuff.
A blown rotator cuff.
Yeah, I injured my right shoulder.
Okay.
Now, it keeps me up at night. And after my health care paid close to $2,500 for MRIs and specialists and physical therapy, I no longer have health care.
And you're still up at night.
I'm still in a great deal of pain.
I shouldn't laugh. I'm sorry.
Is there anything I can do to relieve? Someone said I should keep it stationary. Some people said hot and cold.
All right. Let's stop and say you've actually had an MRI. So do you happen to have the MRI report with you at this moment? If you don't, that's okay, but I'm just asking.
No, I don't have it in my hand, but I did read it through.
Okay. So when a person has an MRI of the shoulder, they tend to list all of the potential things that are wrong, and it'll say something like you have a tear in the labrum, L-A-B-R-U-M, or a tear in the supraspinatus tendon, or a partial tear, and it'll tell you what's inflamed and what's swollen. In general, the most common two injuries with rotator cuff are a tear of the labrum and the supraspinatus tendon either being inflamed or torn. Do either of those ring a bell for you?
The labrum.
Okay. So that's a ring of cartilage that acts as part of the socket.
And if you right.
Have, and
right.
when you have a tear in that, that's difficult to heal. And it can heal with conservative management. It doesn't require surgery. So I want to throw that out right away. But I do want to point out that a lot of times in the early phases of injury, people will be in such pain that they don't move. And as a result of that, they develop secondary issues, frozen shoulder, and persistent inflammation. So very frequently, I will either use, and I use both modalities, either acupuncture or steroids. And quite honestly, I prefer the acupuncture, but I use the steroids a lot because that's what my patients can afford. That's what their insurance will cover. And many of my patients, you know, they can't afford acupuncture, but they can afford their copay. And the insurance company will cover steroid injections. And I think steroid injections work quite well a lot of the time. So I don't have any moral ambiguity about using them. You know, it's like...
Is there a topical steroid?
No, because you can't get deep enough to do anything with it.
I've found, actually, the tiger balm is effective.
Well, tiger balm is a counter-irritant. What that's doing is jamming the nerves. So the nerves don't talk to your spinal column and thence to your brain with a coherent pain signal. So it's like jamming a radio signal. Not a bad idea, but in the long run, not really anti-inflammatory either. So if you're having difficulty with sleep, you've got to find a comfortable position. Usually it's from swelling, so that's where ice and cold packs are probably going to do you more good than heat. When you have tightness of a muscle, that's when I throw the heat in. But when I think it's from swelling or inflammation, which rotator cuff tears usually are, then I think ice is more effective for trying to get some sleep. But then in the morning, when you're before you do your stretching, you want to heat that up to try to open up any muscle spasm that's occurring. When you did your physical therapy, did they give you a home exercise program?
Yes.
Good. Now, that's step one, and it's never any good physical therapy unless they do give you a home program and show you how to maintain the range of motion exercises. Second one, have you actually been doing that?
No, but I do exercise.
Not enough. There are specific movements that help heal a rotator cuff. And if you don't do those movements and you have inflammation in your shoulder, it'll actually get tighter and tighter and tighter and finally freeze up. Mm-hmm. So whenever I see an acute rotator cuff, I always take a moment in my clinic to say to the patient, you have to move this at least minimally in the amount that you can stand. If you don't, it will get worse. And I give them the little lecture, and about half the time they totally ignore me and they come back with a frozen shoulder.
Right.
So I don't know if you've gotten to that point, but if you have gotten to an actual frozen shoulder, then it's going to take months and months to resolve.
Yeah, well, I have a great deal of physical work I'm in retail, and lifting, reaching, it's an activity I'm pursuing all day. There's just certain positions that I can't, I can lift weights, but I can't raise my arm.
Yes, I understand.
You know.
It's because certain muscles in the system aren't working. So I've given you what advice I can. I think that you serve as a good reason why, you know, doing all this technology, but then not really explaining to the person exactly what the mechanism is and exactly how to work within that mechanism, and not emphasizing how important self-care is.
Yeah, well, I think with your I really am attracted to the acupuncture.
Okay, well, there's plenty of that in this town.
Thank you very much.
Good luck. Bye-bye. Let's go to Jackie in San Martin. Hello, Jackie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Good Hi. Morning. I'm curious as to what the options are now for women with regards to birth control. Decades ago, I had experiences with the hormonal types of birth control, and they were kind of primitive back then, but it worked. But nowadays, I have a 19-year-old, and she's trying to make decisions, and there seems to be some new hormones out there, and I've heard a couple scary news stories about those. and didn't know what kind of resources there are and how is one to wade their way through the system of finding birth control that, you know, allows somebody to live their life and do what they want to do. Sometimes it seems like at least the hormonal varieties, or at least a lot of the varieties, don't seem to give you everything that you'd like in life, which is, you know, being able to live your life without interference of these chemicals, but on the other hand, be safe.
Yeah, well, let's start with just off the top. The perfect form of birth control is abstinence on an island where there are only women so that you can't get raped. That would be the perfect form of birth control, but we don't necessarily want to live that life. And the biological imperative, if you're a female, is to become pregnant. If you're a sexually active female, your body wants to become pregnant. That's your natural programming. So before we do anything, let's acknowledge that we're asking for something unnatural in the first place, which is not to get pregnant. And not too surprisingly, there's going to be a trade-off for this unnatural desire that we have, which is not to be pregnant and still have sex. That being said, we've got two categories broadly. You can either prevent the egg from being released, or you can prevent the sperm from getting to the egg. That is to say, prevent the egg from being fertilized. So barrier methods, and I would classify IUD as a barrier method, and I'll come to why I'm saying that in a moment, but barrier methods are condoms, diaphragms, contraceptive foams and jellies, which are aimed at poisoning the sperm before it leaves, vasectomy, again, keeping the sperm from getting to the egg, and then cervical caps, which are still made but very difficult to find. The Today sponge, which is a contraceptive sponge, was off the market, on the market, off the market. I think you can get it online now from Canada or something, but it's not sold in stores and not readily available. And then we move into the IUD, which alters the lining of the uterus and the environment in the uterus and prevents the sperm actually from getting into the tube. The sperm does not make it through a uterus with an IUD in it. Some of the IUDs have progesterone in them, which also minimizes the amount of lining in the uterus, and that is helpful from the standpoint of controlling periods. Many people make an argument, which is not a scientifically validated argument, that induces abortion, because now even if the egg does get fertilized, it can't implant, so that effectively the IUD acts as a morning after pill. That's not true, but you'll hear it a lot. You'll see it a lot as an argument against the IUD in some religious circles. So then let's move over to not letting the egg be released. And those are your hormonal methods. The two hormones we have are basically estrogen and progesterone and various synthetic analogs of those, delivered in a variety of ways. So currently we have one way where you can put a little ring that contains estrogen and progesterone up inside around the cervix, and the estrogen and progesterone diffuse up into the uterus and the ovaries and prevent ovulation. So that's one way of doing it. You can also deliver the estrogen and progesterone through a patch. There are contraceptive injections which deliver estrogen and progesterone, or just progesterone, into the body. And if you just deliver progesterone, you can run into problems with osteoporosis, or at least osteopenia, in other words, thinning of the bones over time. So that's one of those scary newspaper stories that came out in the last 5 years that you may have read. It turns out once you stop the progesterone injections, the bones recover very quickly, but I wouldn't want, in the light of that information, to do that type of contraception for 15 years between, say, 25 and 40. I think you might run into problems with osteoporosis postmenopausally in that scenario. The hormonal methods, the pill, you're very familiar with that, and there are so many different versions of that. You can have the period every 3 months. You can have the triphasic one that helps your acne. You can, all this various marketing that you've probably seen. This one's good for PMS, and the three really gorgeous Sex and the City babes sitting around talking about how wonderful they feel on that pill on the TV ads. But ultimately, all what they do is prevent you from ovulating, and therefore there's no egg to get fertilized. In general, I find that the current birth control pills are very reliable. The patch is something I use quite a bit, but the patch has a higher rate of blood clots, so it has a little bit more complication. I wouldn't recommend the patch in a smoker, even a sometime smoker. The barrier methods, I think, are underused, and that's because of the medical legal implications. If a woman has multiple sexual partners and gets pelvic inflammatory disease and becomes infertile, and she had an IUD in place, everybody knows IUDs cause pelvic inflammatory disease. They don't actually, but everybody knows they do. So doctors can be reluctant to put an IUD in a woman who has multiple partners or who isn't in a long-term married, stable relationship because they're afraid of being blamed for infertility 10 years down the line.
Yeah.
And, you know, fear of blame is epidemic in medical circles. It's just, that's how it is.
A lot of information for a 19-year-old to digest.
It is indeed, and that's why you're there, Mom. You're there to provide the elder woman wisdom assistance in parsing it through. Also understand that your 19-year-old daughter is an individual with an individual physiology and maybe some familial risk factors, maybe some history of migraines or other things that might cause a healthcare professional to push her in one direction or another. And the places like Planned Parenthood and the women's clinics and even the college clinics, they're very good at doing this kind of counseling. They do it all the time. And I think there's lots of good web resources as well. I would start out with Our Bodies Ourselves, which is a really excellent book, and I'm sure they have a website, although I haven't personally gone to it. I would be flabbergasted if they didn't have a good website with good resources in terms of contraceptive information.
Well, that's good, because that's what, you know, she's got the ability to go and digest all this information. And while most of the doctors seem, you know, wanting to help, you know, it is an iterative process because, as you said, you know, your physiology is individual and, you know, things just don't always work out. And it's such a emotional time of life to begin with. It's really hard to figure out how much is from, you know,
exactly
what's going on outside versus what's going on inside.
Is it PMS?
Earlier, yeah. They're all related.
Is it PMS? Is it Pablo didn't text me that? Or is it progesterone?
right. And I myself recall those days, and I remember how difficult it really was. And, wow, you know, you're just like,
yeah.
Well, that make abstinence sound good, but we know that's not realistic.
I got a lot of help from women's health collectives when I was that age. There were free clinics that were women's free clinics. It was the 70s. There was a lot of let's help each other, girl solidarity, and I bet you there still is. That website, by the way, is ourbodiesourselves.org.
Okay, great. All right, thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Let's go to Susan in Monterey. Hello, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn. I wonder if you'd say something about this PDD,
peripheral artery disease.
PAD, I'm sorry. Yeah. I can never remember to say it right. I've been diagnosed with it, and it's right now I'm having a very bad bout, and I'm going to start taking some medicine. I haven't got it yet, but I just wondered, how does it progress? I mean, what?
Well, basically, this is plaque, cholesterol plaque, that is blocking the pipes to your legs. There's a couple of places where the aorta splits is one, and then where the iliac artery splits into the femoral arteries is another. And this is where the blood flow is a little bit bumpy, and that's where plaques tend to form these little plugs. Some people will get a long line of plaque, like an iron deposit in a pipe, and some people will have just a little narrow area. So if you've got a narrow area, sometimes they can actually fix that by going in with a balloon or a stent or doing a bypass. If it's a really long area, then it's major surgery because you have to do a long pipe bypass of some kind. That's in advanced cases. We're doing surgery on people who have a wound on their foot that won't heal because they can't get enough blood out there to heal the wound. So one thing you need to do is be careful with your feet. Don't get blisters. Check your feet. Just like a diabetic would check your feet. Don't wear ill-fitting shoes. Better not to wear sandals without socks. Those sorts of things so that you don't end up with a wound that you're having to heal with poor circulation. The second and most important thing to do is actually exercising, because your body, when it has the oxygen hunger in the cells, those cells have DNA that they open up and they send a signal. They make a signal that says grow more blood vessels. And the grow more blood vessel signal only gets triggered when the cells actually hurt because they don't get enough oxygen. So you have to kind of hurt them in a measured way regularly, and then they get the idea that they need to command the body to grow more blood vessels, and you'll develop what's called collateral circulation. So your little tiny arteries will get bigger and carry more blood. So one of the most important bits of therapy that we have to give to people with this disease is you walk to the point of pain, sit down, use a walker. Sit down on that walker, pull the seat down and sit. Then as soon as your legs don't hurt, you walk again to the point of pain, sit down. And you do that over and over and over again for days and months, and you start to grow new blood vessels. So if you haven't had that advice, that's important. A couple of other things. Hawthorn is an herb that helps with circulation. There's actually some data that you can improve your peripheral circulation with herbs. That's one of the main herbs that has some good data suggesting that. So it's a benign thing, has some antioxidants in it, won't hurt you. Worth trying in a tincture form, for example.
Tincture, okay.
Yeah, that's an alcohol extract of the herb.
Okay.
And any health food store will have a decent hawthorn tincture. And like I said, won't hurt, might help, has some data behind it, so it's definitely worth a try. Drugs like Trentol, they have an interesting mechanism. They make your red blood cells a little soft, and so they can squeeze through a tighter blood vessel, which is a bizarre concept, but does seem to work.
Would you say that again? That
Trentol. Trentol.
Okay.
And that's a pharmaceutical. It's around as generic. Some GI side effects, so not everybody can tolerate it, but it's worth a shot. And it's a good combo, especially with the hawthorn and the walking.
Okay. Well, I certainly appreciate your program and your advice. It's very wonderful, and thank you again.
You are welcome. Have a great day, and
you
go
too.
Take a walk.
I certainly will, indeed. I will.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to our next caller. That's Simon in Soquel. Hello, Simon, and welcome to the program.
Serendipitously, I heard your advice to the man with a bad shoulder. Well, yesterday I went and had my cortisone shot, and relief, pain relief, what a difference a life makes. And I saw the x-rays and got his advice, and he said, basically, you know, if you want full-time relief, you're going to have a shoulder replacement. I just want to get your advice on the success of that. I've Googled around a bit and had a little talk with people who have had it. They say the operation itself is not as bad as the recovery, which caused it. It takes maybe up to a year so that you get somewhat full use of that shoulder again.
Right.
So I don't know what to do. I mean, otherwise it's going to be a cortisone shot every 4 months, and the drugs, painkillers, are just don't work for me.
Okay, well, I can give some general impression on the subject of shoulder replacement surgery. Obviously, it's a value issue, and quite honestly, I have lots of patients who have one replaced joint who come in, not lots, I have about a half dozen people who I inject their other knee regularly because they did the joint replacement. And yeah, it was a lot of pain and a lot of recovery, and they really don't want to do another one right now. And they get by with the steroid shot every 3 months.
Already had a knee replacement.
No, you don't. You missed my point.
Okay.
My point is that this is a person who has decided that they'd rather not have another joint replacement, and they get by just fine with the steroids. And you could just get by fine with the steroids. It sounds like you've responded well.
Except that it only lasts maybe at the outside a week.
Oh, well, then in that case, that's not getting by fine, because we need you to get 2 or 3 months of improvement. Without knowing your exact pathology, whether it's primarily arthritis or whether you have a tear, I can't specifically give you a prognosis as far as what it's likely to do without surgery. You should try conservative measures first, and that means physical therapy modalities, range of motion. I would say also acupuncture, and do all of those things very conscientiously to get a sense for what your life is without surgery. Immediately after your surgery, you will be worse than whatever you've got now.
Yeah.
So you need to allow for, as you said, a year. That's not unusual. I haven't yet had a patient who has had shoulder replacement who would look me in the eye and tell me I would do it again. You know, some of them are like, I don't know. you know, maybe I would do it again. But nobody's like all enthusiastic. Now, this is in contradistinction to knee and hip,
right,
where I have lots of people who have had a knee or a hip. And they're like, yeah, I would do it again if, you know, it was absolutely the right move. I was scared, but it worked out great. I don't hear that with shoulder, and I don't know if it's because of something unique about the shoulder, if it's because we haven't figured out how to do it right yet, because it's a relatively new surgery compared to knee and hip, which they were doing knees and hips when I was in medical school. They've been doing shoulders maybe for 5 years. So they may not really know how to rehabilitate shoulders properly, or they may not have the right shoulder yet developed, technologically speaking.
Yeah.
And it all hinges on how much pain are you in and whether you can live with what you've got or whether you want to go on a lot of heavy pain meds and do a lot of physical therapy with the promise that a year from now or 6 months from now, you'll be a lot better.
Yes. Okay. I've done the physical therapy and at home, followed up, and it got worse.
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, the pain gets worse.
It
does, but then it gets better. The problem is that people don't push through the pain. They give
up. Well, I was told not to. They say, if you feel any pain, back off.
That's at home. When you're with the therapists, they should be pushing you a little bit.
Yes, they did, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so it's up to me to make my decision, Google around, ask people.
Ain't it always. What I would do is I would go to the forums, listen to the people who feel very strongly against and for their shoulder surgery.
How do I get there?
Forums. Well,
they've been mentioned to me before, but
I'm not an expert at this, but I would first go to like Yahoo groups and join. And then there are some other large websites that have groups. But I think if you go to Yahoo groups, there's probably a shoulder replacement group. It seems to be a group for everything.
Yeah.
You could also go to your search engine and put in forum space shoulder replacement.
At Google.
Yep. And that will find you only forums for shoulder replacement.
Yeah.
And some of them will be for orthopedists, and some of them will be for patients.
All right, then. Thank you for your advice.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going now to Bruce in Prunedale. Hello, Bruce, and welcome to the program. Hi.
Good morning. I want to mention, just because I've had rotator cuff experiences, and after going through a lot of time with doctors and physical therapists, it was only until I read an article a year later that I kind of understood what I'd been doing to myself.
Oh, good. Please go on.
Well, and it was kind of simple. It was just saying that basically we're, you know, evolved from apes, and we don't have, at the same time, the upper body strength, if you will, for doing activities, especially repetitive activities, where your hands are over your head. So we're all trained when we pick up a weight off the floor to bend at the knees and not just lean over, but we're not trained how to do things that are over our head. In my case, I was pruning oak trees around my property for a period of days, and that was my injury. When the person mentioned in retail they do a lot of overhead work,
right,
it triggered it. And one of the things that happened was I got the steroid shot, which I felt great. Felt so great, I went back out and pruned trees again the following week and, of course, re-injured myself. And then I had the frozen shoulder and then went through about 5 weeks of intense stretching to get the range of motion back. And during that time, they did do the warm-up, the stretching, and then and stretched it far further than I would have been able to do myself.
Right. There's actually a bizarre acupuncture intervention that I've done. I've done it twice in dancers who had a performance and had a rotator cuff issue. You have to be motivated to do this, but you essentially numb up the shoulder with acupuncture, and then you forcibly range it. You forcibly put it through the full range of motion, and you break up the adhesions like you were doing with your 5 weeks of aggressive stretching, to do it all in one or two sessions. It's extremely intense, and that's why you have to numb the person up using acupuncture anesthesia to be able to pull it off. But
that
makes
a lot of sense.
I've been
pain threshold is key, and then, you know, the physical therapist said that it
exactly
took me half as long as they said most people, but it was because I wanted my shoulder back, so I was willing to deal with more pain,
right,
than, I guess, the average person.
Exactly, and keeping the boundary, figuring out if you got a stoic or a wimp on your hands as a therapist, and then figuring out how hard to push them, that's the art of physical therapy right there. Because if you push the stoic, they will hurt themselves. And if you don't push the wimp, they won't improve.
Yeah, luckily the person I had experience with a Giants baseball team, so he was used to dealing with it. And I noticed when I was at the physical therapist in Gilroy that all the women had basically below-the-waist injuries, and all the men had above-the-waist injuries that were in the physical therapist.
Interesting.
So it was interesting. But
any other advice for our previous caller?
Yeah, one thing was that you really need to strengthen those muscles that are very small as supporting muscles around the rotator cuff. And the tip they gave me that I've since been using over the last decade is to get 15 feet of surgical tubing from your local pharmacy.
Right.
And then you turn it, tie it into a Y with a loop at one end for your doorknob, and
right.
you can do a lot of stretching exercises that strengthen those underdeveloped muscles
yeah.
to support the rotator cuff and prevent re-injury. And, you know, it's like the second caller who talked about, you know, how it starts to hurt again after a while, after a week or two. Well, it's back to looking at the activities you're doing and then whether you've beefed up those muscles around the joint.
Right. It is ultimately a muscle imbalance. It's become very common in our culture because we develop our pectoralis anterior chest muscles, but we don't develop those muscles between the shoulder blades. And so everything gets out of true. And it's just like if you have tires on your car and your wheels aren't aligned, you're going to wear the tires out. We have all got misalignment in our shoulder by the time we hit 50, unless we're doing those exercises you described, rowing type exercising.
Yeah, that's where $10 worth of surgical tubing was fantastic, because you can adjust depending on how far you stand from the doorknob. You can adjust the tension.
It also has other uses, but we won't go into that.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. We're leaving behind shoulders and going to Joan in Felton.
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air.
Happy to talk to you, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
10 days ago, I had surgery for a basal cell carcinoma that was inside my lower right eyelid.
Now, that's an unusual location.
Yes. And they got it out. But in the process, my eyes swelled unbelievably. I mean, I had to go on antibiotics. It was really an ordeal for me and the surgeon. And now the stitches are out, but I've got these red, raw sores inside my eyelid. And she's looking at it saying, you should maybe see an ophthalmologist. And I suddenly last night remembered I have rosacea.
Mm-hmm.
And I remembered something about reading rosacea went to the eyes, and I got on the internet and looked, and I saw pictures of a woman who looked just like me
right.
with the rosacea in her eyelids. And I got that rosacea 2.5 years ago, and I had gamma knife radiation for a meningioma in right. my brain.
I had
surgery for it, and it was growing back. But anyway, my question is, I have some soap. The way I manage the rosacea on my skin and manage it beautifully, a neighbor told me about a friend of hers that had severe, severe symptoms, so terrible, disfiguring. It's a Chinese soap called Chang Xing.
Mm-hmm.
And you just put it on, put the lather on, let it sit there for 3 minutes and rinse it off. And by gosh, it really controls it. But I can't put that soap in my eyes.
You're right. You can't, and you shouldn't try.
No. So what? Do you have any recommendations of what I could do? Because I think that's what it is. The other possibility is I have Lyme disease and the co-infection Babesia, and they will go to the eye too, but I don't think that's what it is.
Well, I think that it's pretty clear that, with your history at least, that you have something wrong with your ability to damp down inflammation. That's why the gamma knife did it to you. Rosacea is a perpetuated and inappropriately perpetuated inflammatory response.
Right.
So broken brake pedal on the inflammation.
Yes.
So how do we augment or use something to drop inflammation? Clearly that's what the soap is doing, or I'd say pretty clearly. And you know, some of those things imported from China, there may be cortisone in that soap.
So they have the ingredients, and it looks all pretty, just some astragalus.
No, they have what they're willing to disclose.
Oh, I see.
Truth in labeling is an issue with imported agents. It's an issue locally, but it's even a bigger issue with imported agents. I'm not saying it's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying you don't really know why it's working. And we definitely have found in certain herbal things coming from China, Benadryl, prednisone, Viagra, you know, you get an impotence treatment that's an herbal, all natural, and it's got Viagra in it. Well, it's like, okay, that'll work. But my point being, I'm glad it's working for your face. I don't really have a problem with you using it on your face. Don't stick it in your eye. What could you do for your eye? Some kind of anti-inflammatory therapy that's approved for the eye would be where I would go first. There is an agent called Acular, A-C-U-L-A-R. It's a form of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory approved for the use in the eye. So that might be a strategy.
Do you need a prescription for that?
Yes, you do. And you should see an ophthalmologist, by the way. You should see someone who takes care of eyeballs, because this could conceivably go to a episcleritis, which is an inflammation of the globe of the eyeball itself, and episcleritis can cause scarring and blindness.
Right. So, that's what I was worried
so
about.
We don't,
I sensed it could happen.
Yeah, we don't play around here. It could be that the surgery itself triggered inflammation. It could be that the stitches triggered inflammation.
Actually, all that inflammation was there for the surgery.
In any event, obviously, it needs specialty care.
Mm-hmm.
But what they might do is, among other things, they might try non-steroidals. If there's any question at all of it being rosacea-like, steroids are problematic because you can get a flare when you stop them.
Mm.
And looking in your other eye, the one that didn't have the surgery, would be my first move to see.
Oh, yeah, it's fine.
I'd want to look very carefully under the eyelids bright light to be sure that you don't have a little bit of involvement there, because then you're on systemic illness, and that's a whole different pathway.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Okay.
If it's Lyme's or it's babesiosa or it's some systemic thing, as you suggested it might be, I would expect to see at least minimal involvement bilaterally. So in terms of trying to figure out what's going on with you, that's how you make or break a diagnosis.
Uh-huh. That's weird, because my Lyme, and often Lyme does this, it's just on the left side of my body.
No, that's not true that often Lyme does that.
Really?
Right.
I have neurological Lyme, and my left optic nerve is involved.
You can, yes, but this
is... but my whole body is...
That's a different story.
Yeah.
You're talking about a mucositis here. You're talking about a mucous membrane.
Right.
Different story.
I see. So I should look at the other eye. See an ophthalmologist.
You see an ophthalmologist. You need to do that.
Acular is a...
Suggest it to the ophthalmologist, see what they say.
Yeah, what kind of drug is it again?
It's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, like a Motrin or an Advil for the eye.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Jan in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jan. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I started laughing when I told your person what the question, but I'm still curious. Okay, here's the thing. I had to have fingerprints taken to get my license.
Uh-huh.
The person, the sheriff's deputy said, well, you know, these aren't very good, but we'll send them in anyway. Your skin is very dry, and I'm not having much success. So I had to send them in. They were returned saying, these fingerprints are not good. You need to get them done again. So I called the people in Sacramento, and they said, well, yeah, you need to do it again, but if they're not good, we're going to reject them. Then you have to go in and have it done manually, where they take each finger, you know, and do that.
You mean when they put ink on your finger?
Yes, that one.
The old-fashioned way.
Yeah, the old-fashioned way. He said, if that doesn't work, then we'll have to do a FBI check on you. So the whole thing is, I use a lot of that the bacterial thing.
Uh-huh. Sure.
Is there any connection between the fact that I don't have fingerprints and that have I erased them by using too much of that stuff?
No, you haven't erased your fingerprints. You've just made it hard for them to register on digital devices.
Yeah.
This is a resolution issue. Like, for example, if the glasses are dirty, you can't see as well through them. If you're trying to read print and it's very pale and gray, it's harder to read, especially when you're dealing with digital devices. And I'm presuming that when they did your fingerprints, they put it on some sort of screen.
Yes.
Yeah. Those have issues in terms of exactly how good a picture they can take.
Okay.
Remember the early digital cameras and how bad they were?
Yes.
Okay. So the technology advances, but at its current state, the technology is not all that good at resolving these lines. And the old technology, which is the ink and the paper, is very good at resolving lines. But then somebody actually has to take those pictures made with ink and paper and turn them into a digital file, which can then be put into a database. And there are technological difficulties with that, because you've got to get the resolution so that it matches the other images. So it's a problem. From a technical standpoint, there's nothing wrong with your fingerprints.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
You just are an outlier in terms of the height and depth of the whorls, whorls. And that may have to do with simply the amount of hand washing. So, yes, indirectly, the soap could be a factor, because if it's dry, if it's desiccated, then the difference essentially in how raised the ridges are is less. And so they're harder to pick up when you push them against glass.
Huh?
But the ink will still pick them up. And believe me, people were trying back from J. Edgar Hoover days, when fingerprints started to be used by the FBI, criminals have been trying to erase fingerprints with acid, with etching, with filing, with all sorts of technologies, with no success at all.
Uh-huh.
Those fingerprints are there for the count. They just may not be picked up in one technology.
Oh, I see. Well, he said, your skin is very dry.
Yeah, that's his point.
So I immediately started using a lot of lotion.
Yeah. I think you might just have to go get your fingerprints taken with paper.
The other way. Okay,
the old-fashioned way.
They said that would be all right. But so I was, you know, I was just really curious. Is it due to dryness?
I think so. I think it's just dryness and friction.
Okay, so not to worry about. But I told
worry.
My friends, if anyone wants a job done with no fingerprints left, I'm the person.
No, don't bet on it. They'll be able to pick it up with the powder at the crime scene.
Oh, I'm glad to know that. Well, okay, so just go ahead and have it done the old-fashioned way and tell them that that's
tell it. Tell them like it or lump it.
All right. Well, thank you for your advice, as always.
Thank you, and thanks for an interesting conundrum.
Okay.
Have a great day.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. It's that time again. We've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. I hope you'll tune in next week when I hope to have a discussion of palliative care with some people intimately involved in that, right here live at the station, taking your calls. Hopefully I can get that together. And as always, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.